this public hearing on the House of Law Amendment Bill. We have tight time frames, so we are going to manage the program quite tightly. We have the following presenters, the Cape Bar Council, the Association of Vets Recovery Agents, the Law Society of South Africa, and the Banking Association of South Africa. We will start with the Bar Council, and it would be important that all presenters speak to the time to afford members an opportunity to put questions. You want to say something? Pardon? Minutes for the presentation and then 20 or so for the session. You are welcome to. I'm sorry, we just had a short consultation to say that it's 20 minutes for the presentation and 20 for the discussion. Is that in order? Are we all happy? Then we'll then take the Cape Bar Council presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have made certain proposals and in essence we agree with the bill. As appears from Title 3 of our submissions, it says there that it appears from the memo that the proposed amendments are primarily geared towards alleviating the plight of certain debtors who find themselves at the receiving end of a debt collecting system and certain common law principles that keep debtors in a state of indebtedness from which it is difficult to escape. There have been recent developments in this area of the law, as we're all aware of, which seek to address the abuses of the debt collection process by credit providers and all their legal rights. The bill incorporates the inroads made by the courts in attempting to restore justice and fairness for this process. Debtors who fall victim to these kinds of abuses are predominantly low-income debtors who may not have the means and the knowledge to enforce protection of their fundamental human rights. This area of the law has long called for further regulation to ensure that the rights of creditors and debtors alike are taken into account in a process that is essentially creditor-driven, especially since the protection of creditors' interests seems to take precedence in this process, regardless of the debtor's financial circumstances, basic human rights, and ability to provide for themselves and independence. In this regard, the Act to look at certain passages of the judgment of the FIJ. It says in paragraph 3 of the judgment, 33 of the judgment, and as we're all aware of the judgment, which I refer to the Universal Symbolic Legal Extension, etc. The individual applicants in this particular matter, since, were all granted loans, often at interest rate of 60% per annum, from a loan originator who previously operated in the Stellenbosch area. The loans were granted without reasonable steps to be taken to assess the applicant's existing financial means, etc. Paragraph 3.1 of the judgment. The individual applicants are a group of low-income earners living in Stellenbosch, supporting themselves and their families on salaries of between 1,200 and 6,000 per month. It also refers to foreign case law. and operates the submissions of claims that there might be debates on the 25% capping. He says, paragraph 44, in the United States of America, federal law places a cap on the amount of an employee's earnings that may be garnished in any 1 week at only 25% of a debtor's after-tax income may be attached per week. Paragraph 67, the International Labour Organization Protection of Wages Convention, the convention, places an obligation on each state to prevent the violation of social economic rights of private actors in its jurisdiction. We, in essence, therefore, support the bill. And then just to run through the clauses, clause one of the bill has proposes to insert a definition as far as difficulty. Clause two of the bill seeks to amend section 36 of the MSA, Magistrate Act, which concerns the precision of judgments. 36 of the APA in the current form does not make provision for a judgment to be rescinded, the procedure to be employed, etc. And then we make the submission that the proposed amendment of section 36 of MCA is patently in the interest of justice. It will serve to address a particular predicament which is commonly fought by many impoverished persons in the debt collecting system, which often serve to perpetuate the financial problems rather than to alleviate them. Clause 3 of the bill seeks to amend 45 of the MCA to permit parties to contend to the jurisdiction of a match court to determine causes of action which would otherwise be beyond the scope of jurisdiction. And then the proposed amendment addresses both following issues. The section 46, I'm not going to go into detail, section 29. And then in essence, the proposed amendment of section 44 of the MCA is clear aimed avoiding a repetition of the deplorable circumstances that give rise to above mentioned cases. There can be no doubt that the object was sought to be achieved by the proposed amendment in the interest of justice. Section 37, 38, 65, all these amendments proposed by clauses 4, 5 and 6 of the bill provide for judicial oversight in that they require that a court make the judgments and the orders currently delegated to the clerk of the court. And much has been made of while sometimes conflict. In essence, states that the clause 4, 5 and 6 of the bill proposed to transform what is essentially a procedural process overseen by clerk of the court. In paragraph 21 of our submissions, clause 8 of the bill proposes amending section 65J, and this was the sole sum in the legal aid clinic judgment, the emoluments, attachment orders, and those who are at the sidebars would appreciate what often happens in the corridors of these courts, where the debtors are just run through and ask what they earn, to what extent they're taxed, to what extent an amount can be garnished against the salaries. And we submit a number of amendments are proposed which are predominantly geared towards protecting the judgment debtor's basic human rights by assessing his ability to pay the judgment debt, including inter alia, an emolument attachment order may only be issued by the court to the imposition of a cap to defaults in the amount of a debtor's salary, maybe exactly in terms of emolument attachment order. I don't know to what extent that is practical, but I suppose if the other submissions will be made in this regard. Further regulation of the procedure in terms of which an amendment to attachment orders may be granted and penalise employers who fail to deduct installments timely and who fail to stop deductions when judgment debt has been satisfied. And we know these particular occasions had occurred, these incidents had occurred that where the debt has been paid and yet debtors are being deducted against. The amendments proposed in respect of 765J of the MCA, 74.56 of the bill seeks to ensure that judgment debtors have sufficient income to provide for itself and the dependents after the deductions of the said installments. I'm not going to go too much into the other submissions, for 710 of the bill, none of the bill, etc., which in effect is practical nature with especially section 9, section 65, to enable the district court to deal with judgment from the higher courts, original and the higher courts, where the matters have been passed for it, to prepare some practicalities and to implement. We can't expect the regional court to sit with that kind of problem or that particular inside. Clause 11 of the building visits amends section 86 of the MCA. This section considers abandonment of judgments. The proposed amendment provides that if a party abandons a judgment given in sole favour, it was judgment deferred and cost unsettled, judgment referred to in page 62 or 3 of the MCA shall not be entered in favour. That makes sense because you often find that debtors pay the judgment with cost and creditors are still, or the attorney for that matter, still object to the judgment being abandoned and or rescinded. Paragraph 27, this amendment should act as a deterrent to, we refer to, fraudulent obtained judgment and so on, to credit providers and of course admin staff who have intended to abuse the debt collection process and exploit the vulnerable position which debtors may find themselves. Clause 13 of the Bill 16 Review, Section 23, in the FCA to provide for rescission of judgments. Just an example, I acted for Transnet in a matter recently where a judge was not inclined to grant rescission despite the fact that there was consent and the long delay understood. The judge is concerned about the long delay for 3 years after the incident. Transnet's issue was that the thousand displays at a big corporate, a massive staff and staff come and go and sums was displaced. Eventually we got to the decision. But it should now make it practical, it should make it implementable with parties consent to a decision of judgments and it shouldn't be a problem to grant a decision. Obviously having viewed about all the facts before the court. And then section 14.1 and 15.3, my junior eyes sat with these particular clauses. We have, of course, the difficulty that if you're going to make the act sort of commencement of the act as a judgment of the SRJ, I don't know to what extent that can be practical, the assumption that any laws that acted should not be suspended. And our view is that if the act is passed, becomes law, it should be from the date of implementation. That's just my personal view. The Bar Council has a different view. It could be from date of judgment of SRJ. I have difficulties with that. I will leave it in the hands of other debaters. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for the short and sweet presentation. Honourable members, the floor is open.
Thank you, Advocate. I just can't understand, is this you're representing the General Counsel of the Bar?
Yes.
Because the submission we've got is by Advocate Tanya Bolden, is that?
I'll tell you what, Tanya is the Chair of the Bar, and she nominated me and Shelley Whitten to have looked at the bill.
Okay.
We made this.
I'm sorry, and your name was again?
Mohammed Sali.
Okay. Thank you, Advocate Sali. Just so you've got, from looking at the submission of the Bar Council, it seems that in broad agreement, and there are one or two technical issues that you need that we really can look at. So that I just wanted to get that sense that there's a very strong sense of support
yes.
to the background of the bill. But I'm quite interested, just you touched on it at the end, the deeming provision right at the end, which obviously relates to the date of the judgment. But it does then have effect of retrospective legislation, and I think that's where you did have a bit of a concern.
Yes.
Would you unpack that a little bit, the concern, because we also need to have an understanding on the court gave a judgment on that date. Is it strictly necessary for us, because you can then have someone taking that provision on review or,
yes.
you know, because it's a retrospective legislation.
Absolutely.
And that could then be a problem for us implementing this legislation.
That's my difficulty with it. You see, this was just the seems to be widely circulated in any event. And the bizarre officers obviously would have had sight of it by now. And I don't think they would be prejudiced to any sort of creditor or debtor for that matter if it's the bull sort of is passed. And there's no respectivity. Perspective, and that's where the Act of Parliament normally applies, you know, is that they then, when it's been implemented, and that's my marginal of the matter.
That would our normal way of approaching this to avoid any problems. But I'm sure that the department has a different view, and it will be interesting at some stage to unpack why they think it should be that retrospective application. Thank you, sir. That's all from my side. Thank you, Advocate Kasali.
Why don't we hear the motivation for making this local retrospective before we even move forward? What is your understanding of the motivation?
Mr. Chair, the motivation is to prevent, as the speaker previously spoke about, the point that there may be reviews and there might be practical difficulties in that regard, because the matter might be in the system for a which law do you apply? Do you apply the current law? Do you apply the transitional law? And to what extent do you apply that transitional law? To my mind, it might give rise to some ambiguities, some confusion in the minds of the presiding officers, and eventually also in regard to the outcome of the matter. And that is short of my position. If you're satisfied with that.
No, sir, I am satisfied, and I think at some stage we would like the department to respond to that as to why they've drafted the bill in that fashion. So thank you, Chair.
No, thank you, Chair. I'm covered by the questions of the Honourable Swart. Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. And thank you very much for the presentation. I think, Chair, the committee should really applaud the level to justify for this landmark project. It will go a long way in terms of alleviating the plight of the poor generally, because if you look at the judgment, it impacts directly on the poor people who can't fight for themselves, who don't have even the money to get. But I think I want to comment on the retrospective. I think it is well crafted. Also, it also responds, because the poor people have been abused for almost a long time now. So in terms of the law provides that the legislature is the one that makes the law. But the courts, in their application of the law and interpretation, they technically also put some input, which technically also amends the law. So from the time the judgment has been given, obviously magistrates and judges are able to almost now speak to what judgment has said. So I think it is also very progressive that sort of retrospectivity is well covered, and it will go a long way in terms of taking the plight of our people forward. Yeah. I think that is my comment, and then that the support the bill.
I think Honorable Bongo will put it very well, because the injustice that has been perpetrated on the poor over a long time needs to be addressed, and if that retrospectivity is to deal with that matter, then for me it makes good sense, unless somebody else feels otherwise. Any other input? Honorable Rittenbach?
Thank you. I thought I'd be coming through. Sorry, would you agree that the dealing position as it now stands is confusing, impractical, and going to lead to discrepancies in how the law is applied, which will give rise to unfairness? And unless you find a mechanism of forcing lenders to correct the position that they find themselves in, the way they deal, the public,
this is going to really chaotic. I'll make the point that there might be uncertainties, and the uncertainties would come before the regarding officers. Which act?
even if it's retrospective, to what extent would the retrospective matter really in this system? Or is it retrospective from a date 2013, 2012? So there must be certainty as regards. Because my junior and I sat long on that issue, and we've made it partially support, but we said in our conclusion also that there should be certainty and we need to mull around that particular point as to when exactly do we want, even if we agree to a perspective sort of issue, to where do we put it? And is it 10 years, 5 years, 3 years? I don't know, it's going to be difficult to make that decision, I suppose.
What's going to happen is you're going to be sitting with a whole lot of essentially illegal agreements, and there's going to be no consequence for it.
There will be matters that have been concluded, and then you cannot go and dig out concluded matters and bring them under this law. But as you correctly say, Advocate Sally, if there are matters that are still current, which still have to be concluded, it must be made clear that they fall under the ambit of this law, and that brings about the certainty that you are talking about. So I can't see any other way of addressing the matter for them, including that clause of prospect. Honorable Sir.
See, Chair, that's the difficulty that arises with transitional provisions. I think that's what Advocate Sally is also, he's alluded to that. Because Section 14 says all legal proceedings which were instituted prior to the commencement of this Act and which are not being concluded must be continued as if this Act has not been passed. So if you've already got legal steps that have been put, that have been instituted, they must be continued and concluded. And then, of course, there is the provisor, the original judgment installment order, upon which the proceeding question are that was obtained and granted in accordance with the law. So, firstly, it says the Act doesn't apply. In other words, the retrospective does apply. But if the judgment was obtained, then it does apply. And so I think, too, I fully agree with your sentiment that the judgment is very progressive. And we're very grateful for Judge Sutton. We're grateful that he can stay on the bench. But that's a side comment. But the issue is legal certainty and to ensure that the provisions and the sentence behind this Act are complied with. So I think it's an issue. I'm grateful for Advocate Sally for raising the concerns about that, but it's not insurmountable. I think that we'll be able to hear from the department as the motivation and in all attempts to make sure that there is legal certainty. I think the transitional provision does give a certain degree of clarity. And I'm sure the courts going forward will also do that. Thank you.
Okay. The letters will be dealt with as if this Act had not been passed. Then it brings us to the point that Honorable Bongo made about addressing the injustice that are being perpetrated on the poor. To say to poor people, we have a new law to address this injustice, but this will not apply to you because we are not. But let us wait.
There is a proviso that says as long as the judgment was obtained in terms of the law, then retrospectivity kicks in. So there is a proviso in Section 14 that covers that concern of yours. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for the initiative and the contribution that we had. You are welcome. Thank
you, Mr. Chair and honourable members. Just prepare a a visual presentation, which due to technical difficulties we cannot display.
I'm advised that the screens are not working, so the members will have to use the PowerPoint, and we apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did bring a couple of copies, hard copies of the presentation, and did distribute it to all members. Unfortunately, they are not numbered, and I cannot assist you in following on the pages provided. ACRA is by and large also in support of this bill. We believe that the objectives of the bill is noted, as they are to be supported. We are, however, concerned that the content of the bill does not necessarily lend itself to obtaining those objectives. In fact, in some instances, we think the bill might have the opposite effect. Just a couple of points which I would like the members to keep in mind as well. We speak of emoluments, attachment orders, or as I referred it in the written submissions and in the legal presentation as EAO, that's the abbreviation for emoluments, attachment orders. The orders are generally seen, or the perception exists, that it is something that comes from a microfinancing industry, that it is only money lent. We heard here this morning of consumers being exploited with reckless lending, etc. The emoluments attachment orders is a general debt enforcement process. There's only two processes, the attachment of a salary or the attachment of assets. All industries make use of either of these two, including the public sector, municipalities, receiver of revenue, healthcare, education. Everyone makes use of this. We mustn't bring things this and see it as a microfinancing exploitative credit practice. That is not what it is. It is of general use. There's no limitation in the Magistrates Court at limiting it to certain types of debt. In my visual presentation, I outlined some of the main objectives of this bill. Don't pretend that it's all the interests concerned, but we must realize there's not only the interest of the consumer at stake, there's also the interest of the Department of Justice and the court system at stake, the economy of the country and the general population. Those interests must be balanced. If it's not balanced, this is a bad bill. As I mentioned, we must also keep in mind throughout that there are only two debt enforcement processes through a court system. It's either an attachment of the salary or portion thereof, or attachment of assets. If we make attachment of salaries an impossibility, the consequences for the consumer will be much more severe than any enforcement of an emoluments attachment order would ever be. We must keep that in mind throughout. Just to deal with the bill very, very briefly, I do not deal with all aspects. Most of the bill we support. Section 57 and 58, subsection 1, capital A, both introduce a very substantial, very arduous onus of proof before an emoluments attachment order can be obtained. It states that the credit provider must provide full particulars of the consumer's income, expenses, of other court orders, other obligations, of all assets and liabilities, and then this must be supported by written proof, bank statements, documentary evidence of all the above, and then when the matter is considered in court, the court may request the latest documentary evidence. Then the thing in section 65J, subsection 1, capital A, introduces a cut system. The first system of providing all this document evidence is in an attempt to determine by the court what in rand value a consumer can afford to apply on a emoluments attachment order while still meeting all his necessary obligations towards himself and his dependents. The cap then limits whatever that amount is to 25% of the consumer salary. This system must be stress tested. Do we achieve what this bill set out to achieve through this structure. Firstly, we must realize this onus of proof in providing all the documentation is on the creditor. But none of the documentation, none of the information is in possession of the creditor. It is in possession of the consumer. The bill states that this evidence must be provided. By stating so, we place the whole system in the hands of the consumer. If the consumer does not cooperate, an order cannot grant this. It's totally dependent on the cooperation of the consumer. It also contains various provisions which increases the cost, and we remember this is a very expensive legal process we are creating here. It increases the cost of this application without any purpose, without any benefit. For example, providing documentary proof of all the assets and liabilities of the consumer. What relevance does that have to what he can afford to pay on a demolition attachment order? Whether he earns a house of 100,000 rand, of 1 million rand, or whether he rents a house, whether he lives with his parents, that asset, that house that he earns, how does that affect his ability to pay? How does that add to what his disposable income is? But the bill requires us to provide documentary evidence of his assets. Generally, anyone here to provide me documentary evidence of your television set. You bought the television set 3 years ago. What's the value? We don't know. But we must provide documentary evidence. Are we now going to have to value or value that item to be able to provide the documentary evidence? That's not relevant in any way. Bank statements does not contribute to determining what the consumer can afford. An item lying on a bank statement, for example, states a reduction of, say, 500 rand to old mutual. We don't know what it's for. We don't know whether it's a necessary expense, whether it's a luxurious expense, on whose behalf that expense is made. We don't know that. Only the consumer can tell us that. The other problem that there is, we live in a paperless society. We don't receive documentary evidence for each and every expense. I challenge anyone to provide me with documentary evidence of the bread and the litre of milk bought on the way home yesterday. The people who travel there by taxi, can anyone produce documentary evidence of that expense of travelling here by taxi? It doesn't exist. But this bill insists on this and states it must be filed with the application. And the court must be satisfied based on that evidence. The bill isn't practical. It cannot be implemented in this way. And then, when the court considers the application, the evidence in the Sy case was, and it was not contested, it was accepted by all, including Judge Desai, was it takes on average 7 months for court to consider such an application from the date that the application is filed. This bill provides that the evidence must be 3 months old. So if the evidence is older than 3 months, when the court considers the bill, the court can ask for the latest evidence. Now we must again try and get the latest evidence, which does not exist. And if it does exist, or insofar as it exists, it is in the possession of the consumer. This bill will bring the courts to a standstill. Currently, or at the time of the Desai matter, the evidence before court, as of September 2014, there was a backlog of 7 months. The latest stat I was able to obtain was that since August 2014, applications that have been handed in by them, only 25% of them have been considered by courts. We're 25 months later, 75% of them have not been considered. The major problem is there isn't magistrates to attend to this massive onus. If we look at our court rolls, go to any magistrate's court, the majority of matters on the court roll involves unsecured credit and the recovery thereof. This bill also lends itself to physical appearances, where in the past these matters were dealt with in chambers. Now the consumer will have to appear in court, and there will be multiple appearances because of this very onus of proof, of documentary evidence, of bank statements, all that must be provided. There will be multiple appearances. We don't have the court system to carry this. We'll bring the Department of Justice or the court system to a standstill. If a consumer does not intend court, we must also realize the Magistrate Court Act provides for a writ for his arrest to be issued in that event. Now we must then arrest these consumers and bring them to court. Under arrest, they are not going to be kept at a civil court. There isn't a vision for us. And do we really want to go and arrest our consumers for debt and go back 50 years to the dark ages where we actually incarcerated people for debt? This is the result that this bill will cause. There is a magistrate. If it should happen that a consumer is arrested for non-appearance and brought to court, there aren't magistrates on standby waiting for such cases. We have a shortage of people to actually deal with these matters. Then, Section 65J1A then provides for this cap. Why does the bill provide for such an onerous sufficient means test, which is practically impossible, but in Section 65J1A says that doesn't matter what that court found. Through the whole investigation, if the court found that the consumer can afford 50% of his salary towards payment of an emoluments attachment order, these are the taxes, this is what the court found, we're going to limit it to 25% anyway. Then the question arises, why go through this sufficient means test? Why go through this onerous process? Why bring our courts to a standstill? And why increase the cost for the consumer? Remember, the consumer pays the legal cost. Why increase the cost for the consumer to such an extent? We're going to at least triple the legal cost of this process. This bill is designed to benefit only the rich. The vulnerable people that we hear of here, hardly ever happens that more than 25% of the salary is attached. In any event, as it currently stands, a person earning 3,000 or 5,000 rand, how much of his salary can he attach? It might be just about nothing. This bill is not going to protect it, it's going to protect the rich. Because a person earning middle or higher income, person earning 50, 60, 70,000 rand, the attachment on his debt is going to be limited to 25%. If the court finds that he can pay 15,000 a month towards his debt, but 25% of his salary is only 5,000 rand, then we must limit it to 5,000 rand. It's only going to happen in the instance of the rich, never of the poor. Are we meeting the objectives of this bill here? I doubt it. The bill creates legal uncertainty as well. It's that 25% of a person's salary. What does 25% mean? Is it gross? Is it net? Is it before tax, after tax? Is it before necessary statutory expenses like medical aid, etc., bonds? We don't know. The bill also doesn't mention whether it includes or excludes maintenance orders. Child and spousal maintenance orders are enforced by way of emoluments attachment orders. They are enforced in some of the same revisions. Aren't we going to give preference to those things? Are they included or excluded? We don't know. Then, the same revision states that should the PAOs, the emoluments attachment orders or the application exceed the 25% mark, then the creditor must give notice to all other creditors, but the bill doesn't say for what purpose. We must give notice to them, but what happens then? Are we then going to have a distribution on a pro rata basis that all creditors are paid, or is it a first-come, first-service basis? If we create a first-come, first-serve basis, we're going to create a feeding frenzy on the consumer. If you're a credit provider, you're going to want to take legal action as aggressively and as quickly as possible to make sure that you come first. If you come third or fourth, you're never going to get paid. So we're encouraging an aggressive debt enforcement system through a legal process which is designed to increase the cost dramatically. The bill has various unintended consequences. The objectives are good, but it contains unintended consequences. It's an impossible process. It's going to lead to the attachment of assets. It will increase the risk for creditors. What are creditors going to be if the risk increases? They're going to limit access to credit. You're not going to grant credit to someone if there's no enforcement process in place. So we're going to deny people a constitutional right to access a credit. We're going to increase the cost of credit for all consumers. This process is very expensive and someone has to foot the bill. The consumer is going to foot the bill here. This is a person we can't protect. We must also realize with the system creating multiple court appearances, consumers must appear in court. They don't get paid when they're in court. The employers do not pay them for civil court attendances. And then we're also going to result in a situation where we are arresting our citizens for non-appearance. And we take this massive risk for absolutely nothing, because the bill says whatever the court finds, we're even going to limit it to 25%. So ignore the court, we're limiting it to 25%. This bill is also in direct conflict, in very serious conflict with other legislation. For example, the Debt Collectors Act. The Debt Collectors Act was introduced firstly in 1998 to alleviate the shortage of magistrates to deal with simple debt collection matters. That was the purpose of that act at that time, to introduce a inclusive, negotiated, amicable debt collection system which is cheap outside the court system. We're reversing this whole process. We're forcing debt collection back into the legal system. It is in conflict with the National Credit Act, specifically Regulation 202, was gazetted in March 2015, gazette number 38557, chapter 3, which contains the sufficient means test, if you want to call it that, which credit provider must apply when a consumer applies for credit. A consumer is too poor to pay his debt, is rich enough to incur new debt. That does not make sense. It does not promote the concept of responsible lending. It's also in conflict with the objectives of the National Credit Act. Why on earth would a consumer want to go under debt review, where on average they pay between 50 to 60% of their salary on the repayment of all their debt? Why would they do that if they can limit it all to 25%? It doesn't make sense. We're going to frustrate and sink the debt review process. This bill is also in direct contravention of the Protection of Personal Information Act. It requires a creditor or consumer to file the most sensitive personal information of a person in public in a court file, which is placing it in the public domain. What can be more personal to a vulnerable consumer than his bank statement? That is where all the internet fraud comes from. That is why we have phishing companies, huge international syndicates preying on people to get this type of information. You're giving it to them. The court or the bill compels us to put this documentation in the public domain. It is unconscionable. The Protection of Personal Information Act imposes a 10 million rand fine per incident where a person's banking details are disclosed to a third party or where it is lost. A 10 million rand fine. That is how serious it is. Here we say, you are compelled to do so. That's on conflict. We're also acting in direct conflict with the global data protection regulations. These are regulations which apply internationally and which states that a country cannot transfer data to another country who does not comply with these regulations. Placing our entire economic system at risk because we fall foul of these international regulations. I've mentioned all these unintended consequences. In my view, this is a bad bill for those reasons. The objectives are fantastic. But how do we achieve those objectives? In my view, it's very, very easy. We've heard in the previous presentation, and those of you who read the design judgment, refer to the American law. That's where this 25% cap comes from. It's from the American law. I have provided you with a copy of the relevant law, section 303 of the Civil Code. And what happens in American law is that you don't go through this very arduous legal process in getting an emolument attachment order. There they call it a writ of garnishment. May I be in about 2-3 minutes? I just need to present the solution because I think that's critical. Thank you. In short, I'm not going to follow the presentation anymore. We're running out of time. Our time was also reduced from 10 minutes to 20 minutes. What happens in American law? Once you have a judgment, any judgment, whether it's a consent judgment in terms of something similar to Section 57 or 58 of our law, where they're signing a file, whatever the situation is, if you have a judgment, you serve a notice on the consumer if the consumer was not present at court, informing him of that judgment. The consumer then has 10 days in which to pay that judgment. If he does not pay the judgment, the credit provider then approaches the court for a writ of garnishment. The writ of garnishment is granted on the request of the creditor and based on an affidavit purely stating there's a judgment granted, this judgment has not been satisfied. That writ of garnishment contains no installment amount whatsoever. Doesn't include that. There's no investigation into the consumer financial position in court whatsoever. There's a statutory cap, the 25% cap, which the employer then must implement. I provided you with copies of the formal documents used in the California state based on Section 303, forms WG002 and 003. Those documents are completed. The one document is completed by the employer. And there is a calculator included in the document stating how to calculate the 25%. The employer completes that, signs the certificate, gives it back to the credit provider, and starts paying the credit provider based on that calculation which the employer does. On the employer, there's also a document, WG002, served on the employer, which contains the rights of the consumer. It's the employer's duty to give this document to the consumer, explain it to him. If the consumer does not agree with the amount being deducted, the consumer fills in a document, it goes back to court, and then a financial inquiry follows.
But you are no longer providing the solution. You are giving examples of the difficulties that we have reached.
This is the solution, Mr. Chair. If we can exclude this from the legal process, and at the briefing session last week, for example, much emphasis was placed on education of the consumer, which is necessary for protection. How are we going to educate the masses of consumers in this country on technical legal aspects? The easy solution is place the onus on the employer. And there is no cost. We do not increase, and that is why we're in the situation, as the previous presenter also mentioned, the consumer finds himself in this spiral of debt that he cannot come out from. It's due to the cost aspect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
From your presentation, it just sounds like there are still many court battles lying ahead. And even as Parliament, we may be finding ourselves being part of those court battles. Honorable Bongo?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, very much. And thanks for the presentation. It appears that it is a well-researched presentation. But I have a lot of fears from this presentation. And I think we may have to share those fears with the committee. Because one, it does not appear that we have read the objective of the bill. And it does not appear like there is an understanding of the historical dynamic perspective of where South Africa comes from and its people. Because in simple terms, the bill seeks to make sure that the garnish orders and all those things that were done in a shenanigan way before by a clerk of a court, the clerk of a court could just sign, then they start deducting in the salary. The track of the court or the credit officers go, the lawyer of the creditor go to the magistrate, they just file without any consultation whatsoever with the consumer. And as a result, majority of poor people, this is practical, this is what is happening on the ground. It's practical, but you go from the presentations like that we have done a desktop exercise, we have not been on the ground to see how many garnishes of the very poor people who are working in the, who are earning far less. Some are not even, some are retrenched, but they're still bit garnished. Some, they have a problem that they have a problem that after they were garnished, they have long paid the money, but the money is still being deducted. There's no recourse. So my understanding of the bill that it seeks to respond to some of those issues. But from your presentation, you also mentioned a lot of legislation that are in place. But you are not saying to the committee, to what extent are we then getting into conflict with this specific legislation that you quote? Like now, you say, this thing originates from the international law. And international law is the law in the Republic. You see, international law in terms of the Constitution is law in the Republic. So you are quoting the protection of the personal information.
Did you say international law or American law?
See, I'm quoting from the presentation. It's the presentation. And we are saying we also quote the Debtors Act. You are not saying to us the extent to which is in conflict with that particular legislation. So I find your presentation to be aloof from the current things that are happening on the ground in the rural areas and the government departments. Because a lot of people who work in government departments there. They are subjected to this issue, which we are not participating in. And what happens when you sign the forms initially? When you sign the forms, that's when some small letters that are being put there, small. When you sign them initially, that's where you consent. You don't consent after. So I think this is what the presentation is just getting me to be confused. I think this research that you have done might be in line with the object of the deal, and it must also have an attitude that knows what is the current situation in the country in terms of this, because that judgment, I have read the judgment, that judgment is a well-researched judgment, and it's a judgment that seeks to alleviate the plight of the majority of South Africans, which I don't agree with you that this deal is to protect the rich, because the rich can afford, the rich have legal representation, the rich can go anywhere for any legal recourse. It's only the poor that do not have legal recourse. That is why we've also created legal aid to assist the poor. Unfortunately, legal aid can't assist in terms of civil litigation, particularly in this aspect. So I think we may need to go back and do a lot of research in terms of what's happening on the ground, because to me it's like it's a helicopter view of what is of what you may perceive is on the ground, but really I sympathize with this research that you have done. I think we may have to come back and assist the committee in terms of how it's in conflict with all the legislations, this aspect and this aspect, this aspect and this aspect, so that when we speak to the department again, we're able to verify and cross-check, and also maybe the committee may have to take a legal advice on some of the issues that you have raised. Thanks for now. I think.
May I respond?
I think Honourable Bongo has given guidance as to what is expected in the light of your presentation. So I want to allow other members to speak. So when you respond, you may refer to what you said. But I think it's clearly helped us in terms of how we should respond. Honourable Bongo,
Thank you, Nicholson. Honorable Bongo has partially covered what I may have wanted to say, but to say that what is important at the end of the day is to really remember and understand the intention of the bill. Within the democratic dispensation of our life, taking into consideration the challenges that we've got as a country, poverty, unemployment, inequality, and to look at what are factors that should actually be taken into consideration to really deal with the situation. Here in this case, what we're looking at is the whole issue of cash lending in South Africa, which actually then has got consequences in terms of debt recovery. That is accompanied by exploitative practices from unscrupulous lenders. That is the fact. This is what is happening, which actually then exacerbates the situation of the challenges that are actually indicated of poverty, unemployment, and inequalities, where people actually end up really, literally having to work in, for a company of the law firm that is actually recovering debt. So the purpose of the bill is to really come up with a mechanism and a system that actually manage to deal with that. And of course, you've actually indicated that something like 35% help, not the others, because if somebody's rich, then what is then there for him? To definitely mean that if it's a billionaire, you only talk of only about 25% of the people of a billion. Which would actually then mean it's something that we need to look at how it's crafted in the bill, so that it doesn't actually lead to this unintended consequence that you're talking about. You've mentioned the situation in terms of the situation of maintenance, health maintenance, where such attachments are made. Indeed, it means that the bill itself should actually also talk to situations of that nature, because the country, we want to see to it that we continue to have a system that ensures that the rights of children and women are actually protected. So at the end of the day, what is important is really understand the intention of this. And this one in particular wants to actually protect lenders in an atmosphere where you find that we have careless lending. Regardless of the National Credit Act provisions, we still have careless lending taking place in South Africa. And that is followed by debt recovery processes that actually become devastating for the lives of the people of South Africa. Thank you, Jackson.
My dear Honorable Swart, Honorable Mutapo, Honorable Hon.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Yonk, for your input. I see that you have been involved as the Association of Debt Recovery Agents from 2012, the various government departments trying to improve the grant you heard on the Industry Garnishee Task Team. And unfortunately, it seems that there wasn't progress in that regard. So you seem to have a history of looking into this issue and trying to improve the legislation or the bills then. And I also noticed that you make it very clear that you have a code of conduct. IDRA has a code of conduct. But obviously the concern that we've faced with is the reckless and unscrupulous lenders that you do refer to in your submission as well. And that gave rise to the Stellenbosch case, which you voluntarily, I would presume, as a friend of the court. I don't think you were an official respondent, but you participated in that. And there you did condemn the conduct that took place there. That is obviously what you are trying to deal with. And the fact of what was occurring in many instances was the obtaining of judgment and garnishee orders by means of in-chambers part due court process. Now, just sorry, you'll be able to respond to that. You seem to support the broad ambit of the bill, and your main focus is on the emoluments attachment order. Is that 65 day, but one would like to have heard more support on all the other issues. I presume then you are, and you're giving your responses, but you support all the other issues. What would be helpful is, what the experience that you've gained in over the years is to present some wording in line with the judgment of both the SAI and the Constitutional Court, because that's what we have to comply with. And we have to strike that balance between the right to access credit and the unscrupulous lenders. And I think that is something that you've gone some way, but it would maybe be helpful to exactly point out, and you're welcome to forward a later written submission. The department will obviously respond as well to the issue, but we are all, well, we will, in all likelihood, all be very strongly supportive of the principles of this bill to deal once and for all with unscrupulous lending practices. That's it. You hear on a daily basis in newspapers about the massive degree of unscrupulous lending that is taking place. And you are focusing on the emoluments attachment order, but obviously there is also the warrants of attachment. That is the second way that creditors can access this. Does it not then just take the step of that right to the point of granting a credit? In South Africa, we know that we've got a society that we've got too much credit. We don't save enough. And so government, finance department, national treasury, all are trying to limit access to credit because of the degree of expectation and that we have too much credit in our society. So this could also be seen in that light. So I think that your input is helpful. You've done a lot of research, but it might be more useful also to start looking at particular wording. But you need to understand that we are broadly in agreement with the principle, what we must be, we are, morally, to deal with what you refer to already as those unscrupulous people that are not part of your association. That is the biggest challenge. That continuous reckless lending, they aren't part of your association, and the abuses that have been perpetrated against many indigent persons. So thank you, Chair, for those few comments.
I think Honourable Short, like Honourable Bongo, are assisting us to open the door for you to make further written submissions, because we don't have time, so when you respond, you don't have to go into details. But before I give you an opportunity, I will ask Honorable Mutapo and Honorable Horn to make their inputs.
Okay, thank you, Sir President. I'm partially covered by Honorable Swart, my apologies. I never. Yes. I'm a bit confused, Chairperson, with the address presentation. As Honorable Swart has already alluded to, you were friends of the court in the Stellenbosch case, isn't it? But it appears you are a bit unsettled. And you'll agree with me that this amendment, as a result of the judgment, of that progressive judgment in Stellenbosch case, which we're part of. So, I don't know, maybe you can share light with maybe me, because some may be aware of address, aims and objectives. And again, the another thing, unfortunately, this presentation is not numbered. Yes. In most cases, you refer to some presentations, submissions dated 12 August 2016, which some of us, I don't have those documents in possession. And you'll agree with me, the sections you are referred to were very critical in that judgment, especially sections 758 and 65. So, but you seem very much unsettled. Maybe you can share light with us, because I personally was thinking that judgment, the amendments were addressing the unconstitutionality to a grave in the Stellenbosch judgment. You are commenting as regards the question.
Maybe you should also tell us what makes you so passionate, because of the constituency you come from, that you really want to exhaust all the avenues to make sure that you are positioned to prevail. Honorable Hon?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I want to first of all say that it would be good if we can get comment on a statement made in this presentation that this bill will make the process of emolument attachment orders impossible. It is the conclusion Adra comes to after doing what I call a stress test. And I want to say that, first of all, I think the sufficient means test is a well-established principle in our law, not only in respect of debt recovery, but even if you look towards the Insolvency Act and insolvency practice, is a well-established principle that the debtor must be left with sufficient means to maintain himself and his dependents in all situations of debt arrangement. And then the only conclusion we can come to is that to a certain extent, and we know that circumstances of an individual debtor may change for different reasons, but in vast majority of cases, when it comes to unpaid debt, the fact is that quite possibly or probably reckless lending, as had been referred to by other colleagues, has already taken place. So then the comment I want to make and want to have a response to is that it is if this, and I don't agree that it makes emolument attachment orders impossible, but if it makes it very difficult, at least to a large extent, it is also the consequence of reckless lending. And why then should we protect ultimately the lender who has not applied the sufficient means test properly in the situation? Then, Chair, in respect of the very interesting information as to how the Americans deal with the calculation, I just want to comment and say that, to my mind, the way, if we settle on 25%, I think that's not certain at this stage, but the way this will be implemented does not need to be addressed by way of the Act. You can always have regulations issued in terms of the Act, and in those regulations the necessary forms or process to get to the point of sufficient means or the 25% or whatever can be, must be done, can be regulated by the Department or the Minister or even Parliament. So I also want to have the comment as to why the position of ARA is that this must be, the solution, as they call it, must already be contained in the Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jonker, I'm sure that somebody else has really asked you this, and so I think you need to have, because you'll get to it. I'm interested to know what the aims of ADRA are and who are the members, and if any of the respondents in the Stellenbosch case were in fact members of ADRA, and if they were, what are the consequences of their actions? Thank you.
Mr. Jonker, you can see that members of this committee have done their homework and they are really putting pointed questions. And I don't think that we should waste time having you to try to justify it. And the good thing from the members is that they are even suggesting they pointed for what responses they need, and even offer you an opportunity to do written submissions. So I'll give you 3 minutes just to respond, but please do respond in writing, because you have done your homework as well very well, and that's why you raised this interest in the quality, and this is a very constructive engagement. That's why we wanted to.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. If I might start right at the back, liking things back to front, I may respond to Honourable Member Rodenbach's question on our participation in the Stellenbosch matter and whether the other respondents are members. No, they're not members. One of the companies involved there applied for membership. We refused their membership. They threatened us with High Court application to compel the, or to compel us to grant their membership. So they're not members and they will never be members. As we stated in those board papers, what happened to those consumers were atrocious. But at the same time, if I may answer some of the other questions, what happened to all those other consumers were, should have been prevented by the application, the proper application of the law at that time. For example, judgments were granted, but the consumer never even consented to that judgment, whether the documentation wasn't signed. Or the consumer signed, but the law states there must be two witnesses signing where there's no witnesses signed, etc., etc. There were consumers who, in their affordability assessment, says a mother with two children said that she has zero expenses for food. It's ridiculous. You don't need to be a magistrate or any legal education to understand something is wrong. We must also then not confuse the letter of the law and the purpose of the law and the compliance outside. What I would like to see followed from that judgment is those clerks who granted those judgments, what happened to them? Are they charged? Are they investigated? Or are they still employed in the Department of Justice granting such ridiculous orders? On the matter of reckless lending, that is something that is very aggressively dealt with by the Department of Trade and Industry. We saw amendments to the National Credit Act. All lenders must now be registered. Previously, there was a limit of, if you have more than 100 credit agreements with an aggregate of more than 500,000 rand, then you have to register as a credit provider. Now, from the very first thing, you have to register and you fall under their jurisdiction. This bill itself provides that a magistrate must satisfy himself that there wasn't reckless lending before granting re-judgment. So that aspect is dealt with in the bill. The magistrate must satisfy himself, and on our proposal that stands. The magistrate must satisfy himself there wasn't reckless lending. The rest is pretty much a compliance issue. We sit with thousands of so-called loan sharks out there, unregistered lenders. What's happening to them? We can put in this bill what we like. We're not going to resolve that problem unless someone goes out and enforces the law. It's a law enforcement issue. The question that my presentation is a bit loose perhaps, I've been to each and every Human Rights Commission convention on this issue. I've dealt with consumers for many years of this. I'm an attorney of profession as well. I've represented many of these consumers in the past. Many of these consumers. I'm very much aware of what is happening in these situations. That is my daily life. I deal with these consumers. They sit across the desk from me. Our solution, what we propose, is take American law, because that's what we're doing in any event. Section 57 and 58.1a is the American law. Take that law, but put it in context, in full context of the American system. What that means is, you apply for a judgment, get your judgment in the normal process. The EAO process is then handled on an employer level, where the consumer has actual assistance in a calm environment where he can be actually assisted. If there is any issue, if the consumer wants to oppose or the creditor, then we go into physical means test in court. Then we can go to court. But why take the consumer? And we say we want to protect the consumer. But who pays the cost of that consumer through this whole legal process? And why I say this process is impossible, and I again ask any of you, if anyone can put up their hand and give me documentary proof of their cost to court this morning in a taxi. If you can give me that, then I'll say this bill is possible. If you can't give me that, you can't get an EAO against that consumer. And that is why I say this bill is impossible to implement. I will, in view of the questions asked, Mr. Chair, I will draft further representations or circulate it. I also had a discussion with Mr. Bassett, who is present here from the Department of Justice. Also requested that I meet with him and further discussing some of these topics, and they indicated that they would be interested in such a discussion. So, if it pleases the Chair, we will provide those written submissions.
From our side, we want all avenues exhausted to ensure that we pass a legislation that is going to end up in court again and in controversies. And I must say that we appreciate the respect that we have done. You have applied your mind to everything, whether or not we agree that's a separate issue, but you did not waste our time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have a provision here for tea break. But there's no tea. So, honorable members and our presenters, I hope you wouldn't mind if we proceed and just take the loss of Central South Africa. This is a bell. Okay. Yes, come nearer. So, Yonker, are you leaving? Are you leaving?
I think I'll stay, Mr. Chair. I am available. I just wanted to make an urgent call.
I think it would be important that you hear others, especially Mr. Bassett as well, so that when you respond to us, you don't cover things that have been geared on. Proceed. Take your seat and relax.
Sorry, let's start again. My name is Graham Ayres. I'm a practicing attorney. Like the previous speaker, I appear for creditors and debtors, and I have on the ground experience of what transpires courts, grant of credit and the like. I chair the Magistrates Court Committees of the Cape Law Society and the Law Society of South Africa, known as the SSA, and I'm also a member of the Rules Board. So it's in that perspective that I'm addressing you. I've been asked by the LSSA to present their submissions, which you would have no doubt have received in written format. And I am proceeding on the basis that you have read and ingested these representations. I'm not going to be too detailed on it. I want to, as a matter of housekeeping, just refer you to page 5 of these submissions. There are certain errors there that I want you to please just rectify, and you can put them on record. Right at the top, there's a proposed section 2B60, that's section 65J, and in fact, those three highlighted sections, proposed section, the first two, relate to section 65J60 and then 10C. And in fact, section 65J10A is also supposed to be affected there. Then there's another error just below that section 10A, is that section in italics where the word recuperate, that is clearly an error. It means recover. To have a step back. Recuperate is when you've been ill and you recover. Probably the draft of this document was Afrikaans and used the incorrect translation of the word. So you want to.
So I just want to make the same as African.
Well,
who are African speaking?
No, I'm just suggesting it as a suggestion. I don't think anything really turns on it politically, but Just from inception, the Law Society's attitude that the intent of this bill is noble, honourable, and to be supported. We're fully aware that one of the greatest disasters post-democracy was Marikana. And one of the things that contributed to this, not the only, was the financial plight of those mine workers who were demonstrating. And what had happened to many of them was that they could afford to live. They were enslaved financially to creditors. And I think part of the intensity of what happened was driven by that. So the Law Society is fully aware of that situation. We, in general, as I say, in support of the amendments that are proposed by this. In particular, the introduction of judicial oversight for monument attachment orders, and the determination of a debtor's needs, the sufficient means for him to be able to live before monies are deducted from his salary to pay creditors, some of whom, as correctly pointed out, may have been reckless lenders. But I'll just park that thought. The important thing, though, is this issue of judicial oversight, particularly when it comes to the determination of the amount payable in terms of an emoluments attachment order. It's also very important that this bill addresses the issue of the jurisdiction. And what was happening previously was that certain scrupulous lenders with their court documentation were getting judgments and the volume of attachment orders, firstly without the judicial oversight that I mentioned earlier, but also out of courts, magistrates' courts, which had absolutely no jurisdiction in truth over the very letters they were fetting. And the result of that was that if they wished to challenge those particular judgments, they would have to travel to courts far away to set aside these judgments. And is this process, particularly the transitional amendment introduced, which is also so well welcomed, going to address that particular problem. So we support that. It's a great amendment that is being introduced. The third thing in particular, rescission of default judgments. You've played with it. Why have this albatross hanging around your neck? The judgment is paid, the debt is settled, there's no reason to have this thing still standing against your name, and you should be able to restore your credit status by rescinding it, by simply proving that your debt has been paid. You don't need the consent of the judgment creditor. What the NSSA is against, and it's
someone need to still will prove it. Why is it not automatic?
Why is it not automatic? Adi Afrim Patem. You have a judgment in place and you want to have it set aside. You're affecting possibly the rights of other people. And therefore the appropriate forum is to have a judicial manner of setting things aside. Okay. There are various concerns that LSSA has in respect to this bill, and they are set out in our 5 pages of representation. The first is a decision that there might be over-legislation on the part of the legislature in dealing with this. There is a judicial system with certain basic fundamental common law principles, ali alterum partem, fairness, all these things that have developed over the decades, if not the centuries. And these processes are very valid, and they're there to deal with applications and fairness as is intended in these amendments. the constraining of magistrates, which results in the enthusiasm of the constraining of the magistrate's discretion, either is achieved through certain of these amendments. Later, I just wish to go through portions of the Act to address that. The prescriptions in the proposed amendments are unnecessarily prescriptive and I think too detailed, and thereby they fetter this judicial discretion which the magistrates already have. In fact, I just want to pause and refer you to Section 65D and its provisions. When a debtor comes to court for what's known as a financial inquiry, and at that inquiry it is determined what the debtor can pay, D1 says that on the appearance at the full court of the judgment debtor, or if a judgment debtor is a juristic person, a director or officer, okay, that deals with juristic persons and so on. Let's find it here. The court in chambers shall, subject to provisions of sub 2 of this section, call upon him or her to give evidence under oath or affirmation on his or her financial position or financial position of the juristic person. Well, that's not too relevant in the context of this discussion, as the case may be. And the court shall permit the examination or cross-examination of the judgment debtor or the judicial officer on all matters relevant to the judgment debtor's financial position and his or her ability to pay the judgment debt. The court shall receive such further evidence as may be produced either orally or affidavit or in such other manner as the court may deem best by on behalf of either the judgment debtor or the judgment creditor as is material to the determination of the judgment debtor's financial position and his or her ability to pay the judgment debt. For the purposes of such evidence, witnesses may be summoned in the manner prescribed in the rules. Amendment 4 says that in determining the ability of the judgment debtor to pay the judgment debt in installments otherwise, the court shall take into consideration, A, in the case of a judgment debtor who is a natural person, the nature of his income, the amounts needed by him for his necessary expenses, and those of the person dependent on him, and for the making of periodical payments which he is advised to make in terms of an order of court, agreement or otherwise in respect of other commitments as disclosed in the evidence presented at the hearing of the proceedings. Now, it's quite clear that this process of determining sufficient means, which is the intention of these amendments, is adequately covered. And we need to ensuring that these amendments are effective, incorporate, I think, what is already practiced and incorporated in legislation. So that is the issue with the first concern of there being over-legislation and fettering unintentionally, obviously, the discretion of magistrates.
Why is that discretion so important?
Because it's a judicial discretion aimed at fairness and affordability, which is the rights of these indigent, in particular indigent creditors, who previously had whose rights were in particular affected by the lack of judicial oversight and the granting of these monuments of patent orders in particular against their salaries.
You don't say that this discretion can be used to favor one side or the other.
No, it is truly and properly exercised, and in my experience, the magistrates in particular before whom I have appeared are judicious in the way in which they determine whether or not the payment installment is affordable by a particular debtor. Okay. The second issue is the intensity with which the relevant sections of the Act, and I'm talking in particular about 57 and 58, intend prescribing in detail as to what evidence is required. By determining what is relevant, they unnecessarily exclude other factors which may be relevant. Now, that's discretion which I've already alluded to, that judicial discretion, is determined by relevant factors and not just those which are listed in the Act. And I think amendment is required to the extent even that those subsections which deal with the format of the applications should be excluded, and the normal and existing parameters of the rules of court which determine how applications are brought and what is not relevant is determined through that process. The rules of court are determined by one of the Department of Justice sub-departments, the Rules Board. I sit on the Rules Board, and they determine how applications are brought, the rules, and then, of course, supported by the common law and, of course, what's in the statute, that relevant section of Section 65 that I read, those are all taken into account in determining how matters are brought to court and what evidence needs to be put before it. In other words, it's not necessary to go to the detail that is set out in the particular amendments. The third issue with which we are concerned is the issue of capping.
So, you have said they are guided by the common law.
Yes.
And that common law is a foreign system to the majority of the people.
Is it necessary? I mean, you know,
it shouldn't that detail cap for those who are not subject to the common law?
Well, as to the extent that the common law may not accord with the rights enshrined in the common law. If the common law doesn't comply with the rights of the common law, if the common law doesn't address the rights of persons or those rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, that particular element of the common law would be against public policy and capable of being struck down. But we're dealing here with the enforcement of contracts. We're dealing here with debtors. We're dealing here with their affordability and their right to live and not to become slaves to credit.
To make it clear that our approach is always biased in favor of common law, Roman-based law, but more than 75% of the population of South Africa are not people of Roman law origin or English origin. Mm-hmm. Why does it seem that the legal system is really informed by European experience, not African experience?
So it's not just common law. There's statutory law as well. And we've seen in the National Credit Act, Consumer Protection Act, the what else is there? There's the PIE Act, the Prevention Against Illegal Eviction Act. There have been moves to change the law, and it is a progressive means by which law does change and make it more consumer-orientated. Now, those principles are also applied in courts. And, you know, we mustn't confuse too much the substantive law, which is all that common law and statutory law, with the procedural law, which is the way in which you bring a matter before court to ensure that both parties are heard and that within the parameters of judicial discretion, the decision is made to achieve fairness. Thank you. The issue of capping. The previous speaker drew a lot of questions on the issue of capping. But I think that the issue of capping, the reasons set out in the representation, and I ask all members here to read those submissions dispassionately, because they do actually highlight a few problems. You'll probably find that in the poor, when you have debtors of the poorest of the poor, that a 25% cap is actually far too high. That allow 25% of a lower income earning debtor to be attached in terms of the anonymous attachment orders, he wouldn't be able to afford it or live or feed his and clothe his family. It is an arbitrary national fixture. What we need is what is envisaged, and I've alluded to it earlier, is an unfettered, judicially exercised discretion where that particular debtor's circumstances are taken into account by an impartial magistrate or even judge, and it is determined on that basis what he can and cannot afford. If you do cap at 25%, the high income earners are going to be getting away with situations where they've taken far too much credit, and they can sit back with 75% of their high income and enjoy life and pay relatively little towards the settlement of their creditors. And that is unfair. It's an arbitrary amount, and it unnecessarily fetters the magistrate or judge's discretion to determine what is fair and right to be paid. So the Law Society does not support that.
Dealing with an equal society like ours, where some people would even say that the majority of the judges, magistrates who are white tend to favor the rich that are present, how would this suggest that there must be no fair discretion addressed that concern?
Chair, it is an unfortunate perception that the majority of judges and magistrates are white, and that implicit therein that they would be biased towards creditors. They are not. I've appeared in magistrates' courts in particular, and the determination of affordability affected by black, coloured, white magistrates of all walks of life is affordability. Before I go into various sections of the Act, I just want to point out or make a suggestion. I appreciate the urgency with which the need for this legislation has come about. I do, however, think that this is too rushed, and I think that a bit more consultation is required from all stakeholders, and I'm not just talking about lawyers, at least attorneys, I'm not just talking about ADRA, the bar, I'm also talking about magistrates, I'm talking about the rules book, and I want to relate something to you. One of the most progressive issues which has come before the rules board has been the attachment and sale and execution of people's primary residences for failure to pay their mortgage bonds, the foreclosure clause. And the rules board has spent, I know it's been a long time, probably 2 years, redrafting, going into the case law, looking at the Gondwana decision and many others. We held a colloquium fairly recently, which all stakeholders were present and came along to participate in redrafting of the court rules relating to what steps should be taken, what should be taken into consideration and the like. And I think that process can be adopted in this institution. I've indicated that the Act puts to usurp the function of the rules board in making rules of court. And I think that the statutory body involved in the promotion of this legislation, this Amendment Act, would benefit greatly by participating in this positive environment of consulting with the rules board to determine whether the rules have to be amended in any way to ensure fairness and justice in terms of determining instalments and emoluments attachment orders. So, yeah, I would suggest that a colloquium or an indaba, it's probably a more appropriate word to use, dialogue is one very good method of considering how to achieve a correct and fair amendment act to go forward on these issues.
Mr. Belders, I wonder, I thought that a law society would also have social responsibility.
We do.
Now, we are here wanting to finalize a law.
Yes.
Now, calling for further consultation, an endeavor. And I guess this endeavor would be amongst lawyers and their stakeholders and so on. Have you ever thought about going to houses of traditional leaders, district houses of traditional leaders, who are on the receiving end of all this process, consult with them? Who else do you think must consult with?
I would suggest that they would have a right to attend, would be welcome, and in fact, whoever facilitates the dialogue I'm suggesting would have better access and knowledge of who should participate in this particular dialogue and put input or give input into the issues. So, I'm not the sole determinator of that.
Because, you see, lawyers are enriched by ordinary people. I never had any dialogue or any colloquium where you just invite these ordinary people and say to them, tell us, what is the feeling of the law, the system, how does it impact on you? Now, I can't see who else do you want us to, because before you come here, you should have actually ensured that there are these consultations. Now the department has done their consultation, and they are satisfied that this is the way to go. And are you saying we must stop here, go back and consult?
I would suggest that that would be appropriate in order to ensure that the problems that are raised here are properly debated and addressed, so that when you come with the final form, everything has been debated, the issues therein fully ventilated, and you will have a collective support for the particular book. There, I was going to go through individual. Well, okay, let me say this to you, that our submissions are fairly fully spelled out here. I've highlighted the main issues, the underlying issues, I ask that these be considered in your deliberations, as well as my suggestion of a colloquium or a dialogue, and obviously all affected parties should be invited, not just lawyers and banks and those institutions that might be perceived to have been causes of problems in this particular issue which the bill seeks to raise. Thank you.
Pass with the submission on that colloquium and indicate who are the people that you think should be invited and what are the outstanding issues that you think are there which has not been covered.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the input. I just wanted to ask you on the previous speaker's concerns about the practical workings of Section 65 in the courts and the proposals. Are you in agreement that it would not work totally at all as presently formulated? I think that is. I'd just like your comments on how you think it will just. We'll obviously put a few questions in to respond to that, so just hang on with that. Okay.
Can I rather just answer individually, because it all gets lost, and there's a lot of good points we've put to you.
I think the challenge is time.
Yes, I know, but I mean,
you know, and that's absolutely
that's why I'm suggesting this.
Hey, I'm not embarrassed.
Should be addressing
I think you can make note of what the member is saying.
So there's plenty of options.
And the point is as well that you feel free again as the previous speaker and all presenters to engage with the department also. But can I just say on the issue of how we've done bills, at this stage of after the department would have advertised the draft bill, it would have gone through that process, they would have consulted in terms of memorandum. If you look there, you would see the departments and parties already consulted. One of which is the rules board. You made specific mention of the rules board.
Yeah.
Now, they have been consulted on this bill. Whether they've made a presentation or not or a submission, they have made certain submissions. So there's been broad consultation.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of a curriculum at this stage is something in my 17 years at Parliament I've never heard of. It might have some benefit, but we dealt with some very contentious pieces of legislation. I mean, you remember the legal practice bill, which took 10 years or something. And you can understand at this point of legislation, with the need to finalize it, that imagine in the context of the legal practice bill having a colloquium, at this point of the legislative process, this wouldn't work. And so I have concerns. I understand your heart and your sentiment to get a broader buy-in. But even on the traditional leaders, the taking from your parliament said it's not necessary. For whatever reason, chairperson, but they said it's not necessary to refer this book to the National House of Traditional Leaders, as it's not, doesn't contain provisions pertaining to customary law. So that is something we can address as a separate issue, but that is already. So I don't see at this stage the need to have a colloquium. I do understand that any other persons can make submissions and can make to improve the bill as presented. And that is why I would strongly, and we will be looking at your suggestions. I'm fully in agreement with the issue of the judiciary discretion. Okay, so just on one question, that the abuses that took place in the past, notwithstanding the existence of common law fairness and all those lovely concepts, I'm an attorney and I've practiced for many years as well. But the problem was it never gets to the judicial office. It's all done in chambers, and that is where a lot of the abuse took place. And that is what we were trying to alleviate. So Chair, just on the issue, so I like your amendment, some of the amendments that you're proposing, and when we go through that, we will deliberate on it further. But the main issue to me is the issue relating to what has happened up to now and reckless lending practices where people have been able to get away in terms of the existing rules, where they went and got a judgment at court, as you pointed out, using existing rules without the necessary judicial oversight, and that's one of the reasons why there is now this need to bring the judiciary in and have hearings, which Mr. Young has pointed out will not work. So somehow we need to reach the balance of what we are presenting and the concerns of Mr. Young. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Breton, for the opportunity. Honorable Chair, the presenter said, asked a question to the department, Mr. Bassetto, why such a rush in amending this legislation? So what I would like to make mention of Gondwana case. Judgment in Gondwana case was delivered in April 2011. Correct? Yes. No, on 11 April 2011. Then Stellenbosch is 2012. Then all these years, the Rouge Board was quiet. What was it doing in this regard? You agree with me that the Constitutional Court held that the High Court Rule 315 was unconstitutional to the extent that it allows judgment debtors' homes to be specially executable by the Registrar of High Court without the consideration and ruling of a High Court. So you made reference to that particular judgment. But my concern, fortunately, you said you serve in the Rules Board. So
But all this 5 years, 4 months, you haven't done anything to attend to all those rules which were declared unconstitutional. So the department now, through its relevant unit, Mr. Bassett, comes before the portfolio committee because of the judgment which was made here in the Western Cape. I just decided to say certain sections of Magistrate Court Act are very much unconstitutional. So she's paid due to that. So the roof got moving at a very snail pace, very slow, taking its time. So they
you see, you are making submissions to the honorable members. So don't be impatient. Allow them to state their case, and I'll give you time to respond. Proceed, honorable members.
So my contention, Chairperson, is that it's the one who made reference to that Kundwani case, where in the judgment, Concord made a ruling in 2011. Since then, the rules voted nothing. Now the department came before the committee, comes before the committee with a bill which was reacting to 2012 judgment. Now my concern is that now he's bringing this issue of why the department rushing the whole thing. But the root court has not done anything since that ruling which is making reference to. That's my contention, Chair President. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really would like to support the suggestion that the documentation be referred to as relevant documentation. It certainly makes more sense in law and allows the court the proper kind of discretion. But, Mr. Chair, I really want to take issue with the comments you made about white magistrates being biased. I find that disrespectful, to say the least. And certainly that white magistrates are biased in favor of the rich, I find offensive. And I take offense.
We are public representatives, and we have a duty to bring to the attention of Parliament and those who make submissions of the perceptions out there. So I was putting a perception to the submitter. So if you have not understood and asked for clarification, I have, like all members of Parliament, a duty to represent the public and to bring to the attention of Parliament what people think about our work so that we respond to that. Thank you very much.
If you want to say that you're representing a perception, you should say so. You should say this is your opinion.
Okay. Hey, starting from the back. Look, I understand where you're coming from in relation to the perception issue, and I think that I did actually answer that, that I feel favoured, no matter the background of the magistrate, his racial background, the law is applied in a fair and judicious way. That's been my experience. Yes, thank you. So I hope that Honourable Breitenbach can take some satisfaction out of that, despite your comments. Okay, but fair enough. Honourable Swart, will the application work or will it not? I think that the onus of proving the, or disproving the defendant's, the judgment debtor's indigency or otherwise, his financial circumstances, does result in a position that it would be impractical and impossible for a judgment creditor to prove what is and what is not affordable, particularly when prescribed in the section of the Act is a requirement of the bank statements. I mean, does every debtor have a bank account? And the last 3 months. And I think that the adverse representation which indicates the procedures, how you approach court, the time lag that's involved. It would be impossible for a judgment creditor to come up with a proper case before court to prove what is or is not affordable. That is a big problem. Section what I was thinking in preparation was Section 5758 is simply going to be a means to acquire a judgment for a capital amount, and then properly the means to test the financial circumstances of the debtor, or the sufficient, apply the sufficient means test, would be to take the matter through to a Section 65 inquiry immediately, where the debtor can be called upon in the notice to produce evidence of income and expenditure, reasonable income and expenditure. I think that is the answer to that first point. Insofar as the consultation issue, the dialogue that he raised, I've just experienced the rule halls, various dialogues on various issues, and as you correctly point out, Chair, if you get the correct people before those dialogues, when I'm not the person that's going to dictate to the Department of Justice as to who they need to invite to the dialogue, but I will certainly contribute to the recommendation, but undoubtedly Justice would know who to invite, and they could, if they want to run a good colloquium or dialogue, they can ask the Rules Board for support. Raj Dyer is a highly competent person when it comes to organising these things. But, you know, the idea of a dialogue, it's a consultative thing. It's not for one party to promote a particular political or socio-economic agenda. Everybody must participate. That's the point I really want to make.
That's true.
What are we amending by way of this amendment? Are we amending the rules of court? The answer, Chair, is no. We are amending legislation of the Department of Justice, which has for all these years allowed default judgments and emoluments attachment order to be granted in the way they were done. Let us not sit here and point fingers at each and everybody. We know there's a problem. We've got to sort it out. Let's not cast stones at each other. Let's work together and let's resolve the problem.
No. I don't think it's casting of stones. It's a call for an explanation.
Yes.
Why 5 years elapsed before you could do something about the matter? So it's not casting stones.
Chair, I've already given you the answer. We deal with the amendment of legislation, not amendment of court rules. Court rules are simply mechanics by which you proceed in a matter to get an order. It doesn't deal, rules court doesn't make the substantive law which allowed, as it was in the past, the issue of judgments, emoluments, attachment order based on consent without judicial oversight. That is a function of Department of Justice and promoting promulgating legislation, putting it to Parliament.
One concern that some of us have, we support the position of Honorable Mutapu, is that the law societies, bank and sales, have the tendency to shelve things or pack things. For instance, when we finalized the legal practice bill, it was the law society which said, wait with Parliament, we'll deal with that later. But even today, there's no initiative from the law society to say, let's deal with paralegal legislation which would assist the majority of the people. So that's why that concern, that we will deal with you, but you don't take the initiative. The department has taken the initiative.
Yes.
And then you want to delay that initiative by saying, let's have a dialogue.
I stand by the recommendation of a dialogue. I think it's an ideal way of getting to the nub of all these issues and sorting them out once and for all. I've made the point about, I'm not going to make it again, that we deal with legislation now, we're not dealing with rules. And I can also say, however, that there are various comments that have emanated from the Rules Board in relation to legislation which touches on procedure. And that's taken a long time to be remedied. But I want to make the point as well that, you know, I'm not here to answer for the Rules Board. You know, if you want the Rules Board to come and address you on these issues, you can do that. And in fact, that would be an ideal topic to raise at the proposed dialogue that I've suggested. Yes, members Swart McCabe and
fashions of the rules but for House of Law, and yes, he's telling the truth. He's not here in his capacity as a member of the board, but I took advantage because he says he's a member of the rules board. And in terms of one of their functions, they have to see to it to review the rules of court and to make amend of the civil rules subject to the approval of the Minister of Justice. So let me pass it there. It took 5 years without doing anything.
Let's pass it and move on to can I gain advice about the tea break, but I don't see any capital that. There is issue. Okay, honorable members, can you have a comfort break and tea break and then come back?